I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan.
Welcome, Jim. I thought today what we could talk a little bit about is the air campaign that's going on against ISIL or ISIS or ICE. I don't know what to call it anymore. They keep using different terms. But anyhow, we have printed some stuff or published some stuff about what's happening with the air campaign and like that. And then I've read a couple of other articles on the internet about it. But the thing that I started thinking about was the debate that's been going on since, I think, the first time a bomb was dropped from an air vehicle, starting in World War I with some of the Zeppelins and like that, was whether you can win a war with just air power. And could you just give us a little history of where that comes from? You know, maybe talk a little bit about Duhay and some of the others that have influenced the Air Force to thinking about how to win a war without ground troops.
Every new weapon tends to be picked up and proclaimed a lot more powerful than it actually is. You know, this goes back to the man on horseback, the armored knight, you know, with stirrups and the whole nine yards. The crossbow at one point was the ultimate weapon. A gunpowder was for a while the ultimate weapon. You see a pattern here, right? All right, air power comes along. Remember, the air power was in its infancy. It was less than 10 years old in 1914 when World War I broke out. But within months, it had become decisive. Generals were quick to realize that the ability to see on demand, as it were, you know, what's going on over the hill or often deep behind enemy lines was crucial. And, of course, that immediately led to, how do we stop the other guy from looking at us? And at that point, you know, the fighter aircraft was invented. At first, you know, with guys with rifles and pistols shooting at each other in the air, and that's a whole other story. But you can see where this is going. After World War I, there were a lot of ideas which were just about to go into operation when World War I ended. There were more bombers being built. There were more ambitious bombing campaigns being planned. The first use of paratroopers was in the works. You know, if the war had gone into 1919, the Germans would have gotten the taste, you know, of Blitzkrieg, you know, long before they invented it 20 years since. During the two world wars, and many theorists came out with ideas about, you know, what this all meant, the usual routine. And General Duhay was one of these theorists. He basically made a very convincing case that air power would be the super weapon of the future, that the ability to bomb or shell, as it were, you know, deliver firepower deep in the enemy rear at headquarters, at logistics facilities and what have you, rendered the modern nation state, which required on railroads and factories and what have you to keep their armed forces going. This was understood from World War I, which was the first industrial war. He said, you know, the air power has the ability to disrupt this. And by disrupting that, you know, you render the enemy much weaker and basically a hollow shell, which can, you know, then a few infantry can go in. Even then they recognize that it really isn't over until your infantry are sitting in the enemy capital and on their railroad stations and what have you. But the idea was that air power could be decisive. It would do most of the heavy lifting. And a lot of this was wishful thinking because the casualties, the millions of casualties in World War I were horrifying to the countries involved. I mean, many of them lost an entire generation, as it were, of young men. Many who are already becoming prominent when they were called up and went to the front, never to return. you know, scientists, engineers, artists, and what have you, poets, you name it. Just, you know, thousands wiped out. They're gone. You know, 4 years later, they're gone. And that, unlike the United States, which did not experience that, this had a profound effect on Europe, all of Europe. And they were ready to basically grab onto this idea that air power could do it with much less loss of life. It didn't work out that way, as we all know. There were several important reasons for that, some of which still apply. First of all, the people on the ground, the target, as it were, is not dumb. They will adapt. People always adapt. I mean, you know, generals, well, military leaders in general, you know, political or professional, they tend to forget the fact that, you know, the other guy is going to react. He's not just going to stand there and get wiped out by your Wonder Woman. This is exactly what happened in World War II. Now, this brought another extreme interpretation of it, that air power was vastly overestimated. Well, that's not true. If you look at the numbers, and for some strange reason, a lot of journalists or even historians don't like to really look at the numbers. It's no fun. But anyway, you look at the numbers and you realize that air power did have an enormous impact. The short form of this is so much air power was used in World War II, not because of Duhay, but because when the United States entered the war, the only weapons we could build quickly were aircraft. It's as simple as that. You know, it took years to build, you know, aircraft carriers and individual aircraft carriers and battleships. It took years to train an infantry division. But, you know, you can have aircraft can be built, you know, in days, literally. It took you a month or two to train the crews, and then you send them off to bomb the enemy. And that's why, you know, this enormous bombing campaign took place over Germany and later Japan. Now, one of the things we got out of that, which is rarely, you know, studied as much as it should, is a large study that was done right after the war called the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey. You know, hundreds of statisticians, researchers, what have you, experts, were sent in, literally while some of these places were still smoldering, to basically talk to the survivors, talk to the people on the ground, try to get a good assessment of how much damage was done, how much damage was not done, what worked, what didn't work. A lot of this was classified for some years after the war, partly, the Air Force would admit this, partly because it was embarrassing. The Air Force and the air power people constantly overestimated the impact of their attacks. But when, you know, the smoke, when the dust settled, as it were, say by the 1970s and 1980s, it was, and I was in the middle of all this, you know, literally lecturing people in the Pentagon on what this all meant, which is another story. But anyway, so I was very familiar early on with, you know, what was going on. I said, look, it was worth it. In other words, all this billions and billions, you know, spent on air power and the, for example, the air war over Germany was very bloody. I mean, a crewman on one of those B-17 or B-24 heavy bombers was more likely to get killed in combat than the infantryman, the American infantryman down below. That's something most people were just ignorant of. But if you look at the numbers, crunch them, you say, oh my God. You know, and this was a horrific campaign. But if you look at the impact it had on the German economy and mobility, it had a big impact. It also helped the Russians a lot, something they wouldn't admit until after the Cold War ended, and their historians could come out and say, yes, we studied the same data, and basically you took the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, away from the Russian front where they were killing us, literally, and ground them up in this air campaign over Germany, which is basically what the air campaign did. It had to basically destroy the Luftwaffe before they could freely bomb most of the major German cities. So it worked, but it didn't work as well as the advocates, the General Duhay and their fans, said it would. Same thing happened after World War II when the nuclear weapons were there. They said, well, now there's no more going to be no more conventional warfare. And I remember I was coming, I was a teenager in the 1950s, and I was in the Army in 1961, when we still had this Pentomic Division, an Army Infantry Division, which was organized for atomic warfare, all sorts of craziness. Then people finally came to their senses, did the numbers again. This is when McNamara, the secretary, came in as Secretary of Defense, and said, now, wait a minute. It's obvious that nuclear weapons are too destructive to use freely. Nobody wants to use it. They're a great threat, and they have caused the major countries to back off on situations where they would earlier have gone in and caused a small war, as it were. But we're still having a lot of these conventional wars, so it hasn't really changed. It's changed everything, but not as much as we thought. So fast forward 50 years to the war on terror, and you have the introduction of smart bombs. This, again, has made changes which people tend to be ignoring. Not ignorant of, I mean, it's there, in that the bombs cause a lot fewer civilian casualties. Now, a lot of journalists know this, but their editors don't want to hear it. I mean, I've spoken to the journalists, and this happened, for example, in 1991, when they were first time the smart bombs were used on a wide scale. They started the first use in 1999 in the... they were also heavily used in 1999, but the first time they were used on a fairly wide basis was in 91. And the Iraqis who were interviewed later said they were amazed. You know, they expected, you know, if Baghdad were going to be bombed, half the city would be leveled, which is how it was before that. You know, everything, Vietnam, Korea, World War II, bombing campaigns meant cities get leveled. You know, to get at the military target, you bomb everything in that vicinity in order to assure you're going to get. But with these smart bombs, you know, Iraqis, you know, were saying, you know, yeah, they took out the Republican Guard headquarters, but it was one building, and that was it. We heard a big boom, you know, some windows were shattered, and you looked out, there's nothing, no damage on the streets, and you looked over at the building, and it was half collapsed. And they were amazed. How could they do that? Just basically hit one bomb, you know, one cruise missile, whatever. And, of course, there were videos released showing, you know, the TV-guided bombs. It was like you were in the bomb, literally. And you could see it going down an air well in the middle of the building complex. And then, boom, partially collapses the building, just takes out the target. Now, this has reduced civilian casualties, collateral damage, by over 80%. Now, this, you never hear this number, but it's a true number. For example, in Normandy, there was over 20,000 civilians killed in the bombing campaign in Normandy and around Normandy against German military targets. But they were often in residential areas and towns and villages and what have you. And the French, you know, I mean, they were unhappy, there were even more Germans killed. So it was a wash. You know, Gallic shrugged of the shoulders and said, you know, vive les Americans. people didn't like it, but they accepted it. That's the way it was. If you wanted to kill the enemy, civilians better run for the hills, which they learned to do. And if they couldn't, they were going to get killed. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. And this means that there is now an even higher premium on no civilian casualties, which is theoretically possible, but as a practical matter, it isn't, because the bad guys, again, the bad guys are not stupid, even if they're Islamic terrorists, which, you know, tend to recruit from the low end of the gene pool, they will literally, by force if necessary, surround themselves with women and children. And that's why, you know, the civilians will flee the approach of Islamic terrorists, ISIL or whatever, or Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, because I know these guys will likely grab some of them and force them to be, you know, human shields from American bombing. Now, it doesn't always guarantee that the American smart bomb won't be dropped anyway. If the target is a high enough value, basically you grit your teeth and say, look, we'll have to take the media and political heat from this, but this guy is important. We got to kill him. And the bombing campaign this time around in Iraq and Syria is working under very strict rules of engagement. In short, we want no civilian casualties. None at all. Now, if there are some, work around that. But the operation, the operating rule is no civilian casualties. So if there's any possibility of civilians being caught in this, you back off. And if you got a really valuable guy like Baghdadi, the guy who's the head of ISIL, well, then kick it up. Our lawyers, the lawyers will argue that, and hopefully we'll decide to go after him before he disappears. This, nobody wants to talk about this. The media doesn't like to, criticize the current U.S. government. And so they basically, play this down, literally ignore it. But this is a major constraint. Another constraint, which has been loosened, is the number of strikes. More are being allowed. And I suspect, again, the government doesn't even like to talk about this, that they have also loosened up on the collateral damage situation. Because, this whole, the media couldn't help itself. They had to say, oh my God, the Iraqis are totally screwed. They're at the gates of Baghdad, and which is not true. The way the war is actually being fought is by, small groups of ISIL. These are irregulars, guys running around in SUVs, pickup trucks, or just cars they've taken from civilians. And of course, from the air, you can't tell if these are civilians in these cars, or it's not like they have their arms out of their things, waving their AK-47s. No, no, they know better. They say, stay inside the damn car. Don't drive like maniacs. Drive like you've got women and children on board, and don't go in big convoys. And that way they can get around. But they've also got telephones, they got walkie-talkies, or they, by pre-arrangement, they say at such and such a time, we will converge at such and such a place, and there'll be several hundred of us, and we'll attack an Iraqi checkpoint or a small base or something like that, and win a great victory, which the Western media, will interpret as, oh my God, the Iraqis are screwed. They are, and they aren't. But the basic problem is the reporting on the air war and the ground campaign is done more from ignorance than from any knowledge of how wars are fought and how this one in particular is different from the ones before it. And that, I think that's the most important thing people can take away from this particular discussion.
Now, the number of sorties that are actually being flown is very low, too, right?
It's been much higher in the last week or two. I think what really got the attention of the American government was the ISIL closing in on Baghdad, making attacks on Abu Ghraib, which is in the outskirts of Baghdad, and other bases, small bases and what have you, compounds. And also in Syria, in Kobani, this is that Kurdish town in the center of the northern Syria, on the Turkish border. The short form of this is the Kurds have been holding off ISIL for 3 years now. And the reason why ISIL has been so intent on constantly attacking the Kurds, who were never active with the rebels against before or against Assad, they were basically hostile to Assad, but they were willing to live and let live, was because you got to remember ISIL, if you don't want to call it something, is basically the sons of Saddam. These are the guys, both nationalists, secular and religious Sunni Arab nationalists, who basically implemented Saddam's, Plan B, which was thought to be a myth. Well, it turned out it wasn't. Plan B was nothing more than Saddam's instruction that, look, if I go down, if my government is destroyed, start a guerrilla war against the occupiers, whoever the hell they are, the Americans, the British, what have you. And we will eventually prevail because the Iraqi Sunnis, who are a minority, they used to be 20%, now they're closer to 15% of the population in Iraq, they, for centuries, have run the country as agents of the Turks or, in their own right. And they believe it's their God-given right. I mean, most Sunnis, Arab Sunnis, believe that as well. It's their God-given right to do all sorts of things. And they really believe it. And, of course, they felt it very strongly when Saddam was overthrown because suddenly all that oil, the majority of the oil income was going to the Sunni minority. And that's why you got all those stories in the 90s of starving Shia, because the Shia, you know, were always getting very little, and they got even less, you know, with the embargo on. So the Sunnis have a lot of incentives to fight, and they kept fighting, even though they were beaten down. The majority of Sunni civilians in 2007 basically agreed to stop supporting the Islamic terrorists, you know, the Sons of Saddam, as it were. And they were crushed, literally. But they were not totally destroyed, and they've slowly built up, especially after the Americans left in 2011, because the Iraqis wouldn't give us the status of forces agreement. And we took our intelligence and special operations people with us, which the Iraqi military at the time told the politicians that this is not good. This will hurt us big time. And the politicians said, oh, no. We control the army, the police, et cetera. Well, we all know how that worked out. But the problem now is that you're fighting both in Syria and in Iraq the same Sunni, you know, superiority, master race, you know, type attitude. And they really had it into the Kurds, because the Kurds have always been, you know, they're like the Israelis. They're always a little more on the ball than the Arabs, and the Arabs resent the heck out of that. Most of the Kurds are Sunni Arab, Sunni Muslims, but they're more, you know, laid back Sufis and what have you. They were never fanatic about it. And this annoyed the heck out of the Sunni Arabs as well. So the ISIL, and before that, other, you know, Sunni terrorist groups in Syria, they kept pushing at the Kurds. And the Kurds were better organized, and they just made the Sunni Arabs angrier by constantly stopping their offensives. Well, in September, when ISIL was on a roll, you know, beyond trying to go beyond Mosul and into the Kurdish areas, for a while, it looked like, you know, the Kurdish territory, the autonomous Kurdish territory in northern Iraq was in trouble. And the Syrians, who had been getting a lot of support from the Iraqi Kurds for years, said, all right, we will divert, you know, our mobile forces, our best forces, what have you. We'll send them, because obviously, you know, we're okay in Syria, and we'll send what help we can, you know, to what's in northern Iraq. Well, when they did that, this is about the time, you know, in August, we started bombing the ISIL in Iraq. And ISIL decided, my God, we're getting bombed now. Not often, you know, four or five times a day, but it's annoying. They hit our obvious targets and what have you. But, gee, they thinned out the Kurdish militias and what have you in Syria, and they're not bombing us in Syria. And, well, do the math. It's obvious what they did. They assembled several thousand, you know, gunmen, artillery, tanks. They had tanks they captured from the Iraqi army in June and July. And they launched this big offensive, which, you know, another mystery, which is not, no intrepid reporter has gotten onto. How did this get past the intelligence people, or did it? And, you know, a lot of the times the intelligence people tell, you know, the president or his aides and what have you, and they just blow them off. But, you know, that is a story in itself, which apparently has not been covered yet. Be that as it may, ISIL pulled the surprise attack off. And before the Kurds could shift people back, because they had stopped, you know, the advance in Iraq, and now they're basically pushing back ISIL, they got hit with two things. One, ISIL was attacking from the south, and the Turks decided, we're not going to allow any weapons, any armed men to cross from Turkey into Syria anymore, especially if they're Kurds. Now, this is very cynical on the part of the Turks, who also have it in for the Kurds, simply because the Kurds have never been good Turks. You know, for generations, the Turks called the Kurds mountain Turks, which the Kurds greatly resented. The Kurds, you got to remember, are Indo-European people. They're related to the Iranians and the Europeans. And for some reason, they got stuck where they are centuries, thousand years ago, and they kept fighting among themselves and never got organized. Sounds like the Celts, the Celts, and to a lesser extent, the Germans. But anyway, there they are. And the Turks said, hey, you know, here's our chance to really, you know, take care of this, stick it to those Syrian Kurds, because the Syrian Kurds had been a particular problem for the Turks for reasons I won't go into now. And Turkey's taking a lot of heat for this policy, which at first, they, you know, people said, no, they couldn't be doing that. After a while, the majority of observers said, oh, my God, the Turks are. So the only recourse, the only help, decisive help, that the Kurds could depend upon was this air campaign, which began on the 23rd of September in Syria. And, of course, the Kurds, God bless them, they have a pretty good lobby in the United States and in the West in general. And apparently they got to the United States government and said, look, this is going to reflect very badly on you if you do nothing. You know, you want another Rwanda on your hands? Granted, the Turks did let 200,000 Kurdish civilians across, but there are thousands of civilians, you know, still on the Syrian side. You know, if they take this town and they go right up to the Syria, the Turkish border, you're going to have thousands, you're going to have horrific pictures, and the fingers are going to point at you, the United States, because you can do something. You can do a lot more bombing. You can send in some special forces to help control the bombing. Yada, yada, yada. Maybe talk to the Turks, although we're not expecting any progress in that department. We know the Turks. They're bastards. They don't like us yet. So, you know, we can't change that quickly. But you can do something. And the United States apparently has stepped up. There have been, you know, two or three times the number of attacks. You know, there have been as high as 20 or 30 sorties a day. And apparently the Kurds have, as they usually do, they work very well with us. They're one of the few friends we have over in that part of the world. You know, and they've consistently, you know, been willing to work with us with a minimum of nonsense. And we probably do have special forces teams in there who basically can call in airstrikes, you know, with no screwing around. They give the passwords, and, you know, you got an American voice down there, and bingo, the bombs come in, and they hit where they're supposed to. And this is doing a lot of damage to the ISIL. You know, Kobani in Syria is an example of where the air campaign is succeeding. And it's actually succeeding any place where you have reliable ground forces involved. This means the Kurds. The Kurds are pushing ISIL back in the north because they're reliable, they're well-trained. They've had over 20 years of experience with American trainers. Again, the Peshmerga, are most of them are not full-time soldiers. They're sort of a reserve force, but they train regularly, like in Israel. They get called up regularly for guard duty, patrolling, and what have you. In that part of the world, they are the most reliable troops you've got, aside from the, you know, Jordanian regulars, as it were. And the Iranians have some good troops, but on our side, you know, the only ones we can really depend upon are the Kurds. The problem in Baghdad, and, you know, down in central Iraq, is that we released a study that the special forces had done of the Iraqi army over the last 2 months, and basically said half the brigades are trashed because they're all political officers. You basically haven't got enough competent officers. And every time you look at a defeat by the Iraqis in the last month or so, you'll find it's all the leadership. There's an old military saying, there are no bad troops, only bad officers. And of course, this was discovered again and again in Iraq. You know, American special forces who specialize in training foreign troops, they said, you know, we got some excellent Iraqi soldiers. You know, you train them up, give them good leadership, get some good NCOs, and they're as good as Americans, you know, for raiding, patrolling, and what have you. But once you get corrupt, politicized officers in their chain of command, they become useless. They will not fight. They will not risk their lives for clowns like this. And that's still the problem with the Iraqi armed forces and Arab armed forces in general. But the Kurds we can depend upon, and apparently they are delivering for us, as it were, for the anti-ISIL coalition, both in Syria and in Iraq. But there are not enough Kurds to supply all the ground forces needed to destroy ISIL, you know, quickly. And that's what Americans, that's what Westerners want. They don't want, you know, a long war, which the American leadership has said, like President Bush did over 10 years ago, this is going to be a long war. I mean, these our leaders are not stupid people. They may be venal, they may be a little more political than practical, but you explain these things to them, and they understand it. Their problem is, well, how do I implement this and get reelected? Which, you know, understandably is something a politician has to worry about.
Right.
And that's the problem in Iraq right now. It's more here than there.
Yeah. Now, one of the things with the first Gulf War and then with Iraq in 2003, our air campaign started off with the concept that the Air Force had been developing since, you know, World War II, which was this systemic actions of trying to cut communication lines, trying to decapitate command structures and like that. But that's that approach here, we're in an asymmetric war with these guys, and it's a lot harder to track those things down, right?
Well, yes, but something you have to remember, this asymmetric, you know, warfare is thrown around a lot. And what people forget is that all warfare is asymmetric. The whole point of winning a war is to become asymmetric. Asymmetric means doing something the enemy doesn't anticipate. Again, there's a dozen or so military sayings which sum up the wisdom which controls all military operations. One of them is, no plan survives contact with the enemy. And this is basically, again, the point that the other guy is not going to stand still and allow you to come up with some perfect plan that's going to wipe them out in one fell swoop. This is a fallacy the Air Force has been chasing for years. Now, during the Cold War, it had some validity because the Russians were famous or infamous for having a very strict chain of command and command structure. And they've had this for a long time. The Germans were defeating the Russians right up until the end of World War II because of this. But the Russians had numbers. As the Russians like to point out, quantity has a quality all of its own. And in the end, the Russians won. I mean, they lost 10 million people, soldiers, and another 20 million civilians. But they won. And that's what they didn't let their eye get off the goal to win, no matter what. The Islamic terrorists are, again, have a maybe stupid in many ways and evil, but they have a sense of self-preservation. They can't do what they want to do if they're getting wiped out by bombs, and they will find ways. And this is something I've lectured the Air Force again and again and again. I mean, it really embarrassed them. You know, down at the Air Force War College and Pentagon and what have you, I said, look, guys, you consistently, and I reel off example after example, you know, ignore the fact that the enemy is going to be finding ways to fool you. And they constantly do it. Now, to their credit, not necessarily because of me, but I think because a new generation was coming up saying, you know, we've been making these same mistakes again and again. Maybe we can fix it. You know, not just this crazy Dunnigan guy, you know. I wasn't the only one preaching this, you know, gospel, as it were. And they have become more practical. But what they're having to contend with now is this idea that zero civilians must die. And that doesn't happen in any war. And the fact that the civilian deaths are down over 80%, you know, in the last few decades doesn't wash either, which is stupid. It's ridiculous, but that's, you know, the power of, you know, mass thinking, as it were. And you have to deal with it. But the Air Force does do very well what they are equipped to do, and that is to put, you know, precision, you know, bombs and missiles on targets, minimizing as much as humanly possible, you know, any collateral damage. They are extremely good at that. And that's what they are doing now in Kobani, for example, because almost all the civilians have left. The only people in that town are ISIL and the Kurds and other rebels defending the place. And the Air Force loves that kind of situation because it's understood. The guys on the ground, you're getting American air support. You have to keep track of where your people are because when the American ground control, and I'm assuming they're special forces guys or there may be some Kurds who've been trained well enough and trusted to do it, when they say, clear to hit, that means clear of all, you know, friendly, you know, forces. And we even developed in the last 10 years special bombs that have a smaller blast radius. I mean, literally, they will, and that's why small weapons like the Hellfire missile, which is only about 100 pounds, are favored, because, I mean, literally, you can fire one of those through the window of a building, and it will just destroy a couple of rooms. And unless people get hit by flying glass or other debris and what have you, you're not going to have people next door being killed en masse. So this can, the Air Force can do what it does and do it very well and do it on command, as it were, but they have to have the right conditions. And the enemy will, and we know this from experience, they have a big bag of tricks. I mean, there are documents on the internet written in Arabic and the languages of Urdu and Pashtun and what have you that the terrorists in Afghanistan and Pakistan speak, give them the practical advice on how to, you know, lessen your exposure to these American smart bombs. But they only work up to a point. And if these guys in a street battle, which is, you know, urban combat, which is what they're involved in right now, they are in an unfavorable position. They have not made their situation asymmetric. It's very symmetric. It's front lines. It's World War I. And when you're in a situation like that and you have your opponent has control of the air and a lot of experienced pilots using smart bombs and guided missiles, you are dead meat. So you either have to, quickly overcome the opposition. In this case, the Kurds are not easy to overcome. Or you have to get the hell out of there and admit you were defeated. So this is why we are winning, and again, because of air power, but the conditions have to be right. They aren't always right.
So we're winning in the north, but in the south, things don't look so good.
In Baghdad, yes. Well, right. off to the east. Yeah, Baghdad's a problem because this is an urban area full of not just Shia, but Sunnis who are supporting. For example, today, there were a number of terrorist attacks in Baghdad, you know, car bombs and truck bombs and what have you, suicide bombers, because you still have a large Sunni population in and around Baghdad who can drive in acting like, hey, I'm just Joe, you know, I'm Abdul Blow, you know, delivering watermelons, you know, to the market and what have you. You know, don't pay any attention to that half a ton of explosives underneath the watermelons. And they can still do this. I mean, now the Iraqis have a tremendous incentive to have tight security, but they can still be bribed. I mean, they still put up, they tolerate so much of this corruption. Everybody complains about it. But, you know, when the Abdul, you know, the terrorist comes up and puts a couple $100 bills, you know, and waves them in front of you, with the implication that either you take the money or I'm going to detonate it right now, you're going to die. You know, it's a difficult situation. It's not all black and white. You know, it's not easy to deal with. The Shia Arabs in Iraq have not been able to deal with it well as they could. And they're suffering as a consequence. I mean, the big flaw was throwing the Americans out in 2011. I mean, a lot of Iraqis over there are saying, they don't say it too loudly because people get mad over there and, you know, they pull a gun out. They said, we told you so, you know, and the American Special Forces and the intelligence assets are now going back in there, but it's not like a light switch. You know, you don't just flip a switch and bing, the lights come on. It's going to take weeks or months. Progress is going to be slow. And in the meantime, I doubt very much if Baghdad will fall, because quite literally, ISIL doesn't have the manpower. Thousands, tens of thousands of the Shia inside Baghdad have weapons. They're organized in militias. They will fight to defend their neighborhoods. And what these Sunnis ultimately have to worry about is the fact that if push comes to shove, the government can basically tell the Shia militias, especially the hardcore ones, go after all Sunnis. All Sunnis must die. And this happened before in the Middle East. This is what's happening before 2007. It's one reason why the Sunni tribal chief said, hey, you know, this is not working. These death squads, these Shia death squads, you know, we can't stop them, and people are just getting popped, you know, right and left, men, women, and children, but mostly men, you know, which has focused the attention of the tribal leaders who are all male. This still imposes a certain degree of restraint on the Sunni civilian leaders. But a lot of them, a lot of the young guys, one young student is saying, hey, ISIL, that's where it's at, man. My father's generation had all this money, these great jobs under Saddam, and they lost it. And, man, I'd like to get that back, and I'm willing to take a chance. But the older guys saying, hey, no, man, you know, this can be suicidal, and there's no gain in that. And so this is, you're going to have a confused situation for several more weeks, if not to the end of the year. But again, historically, you can look at it. This is a pattern that keeps repeating itself. ISIL is going to burn itself out. They've been so brutal, even Al-Qaeda has condemned it. Now, this is unusual. You know, they are basically a branch. They started out as a branch of Al-Qaeda. They've always been the bad boys of Al-Qaeda, as it were. Last year, they were basically, or earlier this year, they were drummed out of Al-Qaeda, and they've been condemned several times since then. So it's cool being the baddest of the bad, but long term it's a poor career choice.
Right. Now, in order to, the Kurds will probably push back and take their territory with our help. The question mark is, will the Iraqis be able to get their act together to push back and take the territory?
In time. Right. One thing we try to do is strategy pages. We have sources over there and here and what have you, and you know, it's like shaking a tree. You just hope the right kinds of apples fall down. I'm trying to find clues, as it were, that the effort to clean up the officer corps and the Iraqi security forces is working. Right now I'm getting mixed signals. There are some changes, but a lot of the well-connected officers who are basically just there because they're loyal and they're, you know, they support, you know, one clique or another of corrupt Shia politicians, it means they can't be moved. Now, this was a problem even before 2011, before we left. I mean, the Americans were constantly complaining to the Iraqi government about that. It's also a problem in Afghanistan. It's a problem in most of the world. Until there are a lot of changes in the military leadership, the Iraqis won't be able to depend upon their fighters, their troops, as it were, as well as the Kurds can depend on theirs. Now, the Kurds have corruption. I mean, they're not saints up there. But when it comes to security and defense, the Kurds are a lot more on the ball. They tend to say, you know, get another job for your nephew. You know, he's not officer material. So they do have a tradition they've established, again, partially by working with the American Special Forces for decades. And because the Americans will come in there, and a lot of these American Special Forces guys speak Kurdish, and they'll ream you out in Kurdish, some very colorful Kurdish, I'm told. You know, if you basically put some dodo in as a company commander who's known to be, you know, just somebody's nephew. So the Kurds have a tremendous advantage, and until the Shias, you know, get this, and a lot of them know it. I mean, a lot of Shia, you know, a lot of Iraqis know that the corruption is the major problem, but overcoming it is not easy. It's not like flipping a switch, and God bless them, they're trying, but until they actually do it, they're going to be at a disadvantage towards any, bunch of fanatics who are basically willing to bribe or kill or threaten or whatever to get what they want. I mean, eventually they'll burn themselves out, but in the meantime, they do a lot of damage. And this is a cycle that's been going on for centuries. It's about time. You know, we can do is tell them, like a broken record. Who knows what a record is anymore? But anyway, we just keep repeating ourselves. You know, this is the solution. You've got to implement it. Otherwise, you're not going to change. It is changing. It is changing slowly. People forget that Europe and the United States, for that matter, used to be as corrupt as, maybe not as corrupt, but very corrupt. And there were reforms. I mean, we did reform ourselves. But it takes time. We're talking generations, you know, not months.
Right. And so this is something we'll be, especially in the Baghdad area and the territories of Iraq, we'll be talking about for some time.
Indeed.
All right. We'll talk to you next time, Jim,
okay.
And have a good day.
Take care.